This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we are going over Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, chapters 11 and 12, Aboard the Hogwarts Express and the Tri-Wizard Tournament. In these chapters, we get a nice long trip on the Hogwarts Express, going over lots of miscellaneous stuff, and then we finally in 12 get the explanation of what exactly is going on. You knew about from pop culture.
I did know about that, but now like what's involved, I don't know so much. But you know, we're really taking our time getting to Hogwarts this go around, so that's all right.
Yes. Taking a very long time to get to Hogwarts and just interesting so much, I guess, you know, fluff after such, again, the dark chapter of the Dark Mark. We're still trying to process that and get a little bit of happy.
Right. Yeah. We're really kind of, what am I trying to say? This chapter, as I'm looking at it, like, you know what I'm looking at, everybody. Aboard the Hogwarts Express was kind of a mixed, sorry, what am I trying to say? It was just kind of a lot of things happening, but at least we are on the way to Hogwarts to kind of discover the, I don't know. I have a lot of questions. I'm going to hold until we get to the second chapter.
So the biggest thing is, you know, they wake up and it's pouring down rain. And the big thing is that while they're getting ready at the Burrow, Arthur gets this message from Amos. And we've learned that the flu cannot just be purely like teleportation transporting people, but it can also be FaceTime, flu time.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's like the Wizarding Zoom or something, or FaceTime.
It's flu time.
Flu time. There we go. That's, man, I wish somebody would have named the FaceTime like after this, you know, that would have been more fun. Obviously we're talking about the fallout from the Quidditch World Cup is still ongoing, and this is just kind of talking about that as well. And then we're introduced to another character who I have seen, but I don't know much about. So
yes. So Amos is telling Arthur that Mad-Eye Moody has enchanted some dustbins, causing a racket to the point that his muggle neighbors have called the police, you know, on him.
Yeah, which this was all kind of all over the place a little bit, because it sounds like Arthur and Mad-Eye Moody have a pretty decent relationship. Mad-Eye Moody is kind of known to be a little bit of a, what do they call him, a nutter. Which I know that's something that is said quite often overseas. But Arthur's kind of defending him, and then also kind of mentions that he's a friend of Dumbledore's too. So trying to get him, give him some sort of credibility. I believe it's the Weasley kids who are questioning what the heck's going on here.
Yeah. So, cause as you probably noted, Arthur was willing to entertain the possibility. Okay. Did like you catch the intruders? Like, did he describe them? And Amos is just pure dismissal of, you know, how paranoid he is and he's gotten in his old age. It's not anything really.
Yeah. And this is Amos Diggory, right?
Yes.
Well, so I guess, you know, kind of noting about Cedric, and he's kind of a decent person. He must really balance out like his dad's kind of pompousness.
Yeah, I'm assuming Cedric takes after his mother.
There we go. Yes. Don't know why I didn't think about that. But.
Yes. And so, again, lots of, again, in misuse, improper use of Muggle artifacts. So they're like, Arthur, please go and help him, please. Otherwise, it'll just be a terrible mess. And so Arthur decides to go. And Molly's like, are you sure you don't want anything to eat? And she literally just gives him the toast into the fire and he catches it in his mouth.
That's a pretty silly, like, that's pretty cute though. I'm not that gifted. I'm not like, what is it? I think it's Benihana, where you catch shrimp in your mouth. I guess I would have to catch tofu anyway, so.
Yeah. Mad-Eye Moody, said George, thoughtfully spreading marmalade on his toast. And isn't he that nutter? Your father thinks very highly of Mad-Eye Moody, said Mrs. Weasley sternly. Yeah, well, Dad collects plugs, doesn't he?
Again, like, being a jerk toward their father. Like, I understand. I guess, I don't know. I like my dad, so I don't really get some of this. But especially in front of, you know, his wife, it's a little crazy.
No, well, this is George saying this.
Right, about his dad.
Yeah. So, he's retired, used to be at the ministry. I met him once when Dad took me into work with him. He was one of the best, a dark wizard catcher. So it's just interesting to get this sort of tidbit of, you know, clearly he was very respected and basically was a really badass wizarding cop who the Azkaban, 50% of all the people in Azkaban are in there because of Mad-Eye Moody. And so... It was interesting, this dynamic of someone, like, you know, who is clearly very well respected, but now has been perceived to go senile or paranoid and is seen as sort of troublesome. Kind of reminds me of a certain relationship I have with someone at work who, great respect for him, but at a certain age, it's like, why you keep doing this to yourself? Just go retire.
That's the profession that I work with. They tend to hold on to their licenses for a long time. I was helping somebody on a call and she was like, I'm 74. And I was like, what? But I mean, power to them, you know, but still there's a little bit of a,
if they're still lucid, great.
Yeah. I don't know if that's always, that's the trouble. You know what? This reminded me of Mad-Eye Moody, kind of reminded me of a mafia boss. And, you know, putting mobsters in jail and therefore his life is kind of always in danger. So I'm sure we'll get to learn more about his kind of background. Hopefully I know where he shows up here in a little bit, but he has definitely, I'm sure catching dark wizards has affected him a little bit.
Yes, indeed. Probably a little bit of PTSD. But were you able to put it together? Because they mention in this chapter that, you know, please help him out because of all days, this is the day where he's supposed to be starting his new job.
Yeah, you know, I did for some reason. I, again, just the Harry Potter is so ingrained in our pop culture that it's hard to not see some things. So I can see the character as he was depicted in the movie, and I knew he was at Hogwarts for some reason. And then I didn't know he would be the Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher, but I did know he would be at Hogwarts. So this kind of did help me kind of figure that out a little bit.
And so they've got no ministry cars to help them out. So they literally just took a bunch of Muggle taxis into London, which, just thinking about it, just seems really awful with all the owls and Crookshanks and everything.
Yeah, Crookshanks isn't too thrilled about that either. I was thinking about the owls, and a lot of people keep exotic pets anymore. Like, I don't really know particularly how I feel about that, but I guess maybe it wouldn't be too shocking, but the owls to me would be a little bit like, what's going on here? You know, might raise a couple flags.
Yeah. And then, again, there's also the question of, wouldn't you just release the owls to go to Hogwarts?
That's a great question. That's a great point.
Unless you want to cuddle and, you know, cuddle with your owl on the Hogwarts Express, that's fine. But Ron doesn't do that. He shoves his ugly Victorian-style dress robes over Pigwidgeon's cage.
I know. Poor Pigwidgeon. He's just we love him, but Ron doesn't feel the same, which maybe one day he'll learn. I don't know.
Yeah. So yeah, get into, drive into London, get to King's Cross, get on platform 9¾, get on the Hogwarts Express, and then, you know, they keep dropping hints about the you-know-what.
Yeah. I just want to say, like, I feel like this was really well done. The Harry's, like, retelling of how they got to, you know, the platform and stuff. It kind of assumes, finally, he assumes that maybe you've read the first three books, that he doesn't need to get into the details. So I appreciated that a little bit.
Yeah, that it was just more, this is what we do.
Right. This is how it goes. And Harry, I don't think, is enamored or, like, you know, just kind of, oh my gosh, it's all so strange. Now it's just kind of like old hat.
Yeah. Well, Amanda and Kevin just recently did their episode critiquing the adaptation of the 6th Harry Potter book, Half-Blood Prince. And one of Kevin's biggest criticism, especially that movie, but generally the wider Harry Potter movies, is the sense of they constantly trying to focus on the, wow, it's magical and there are witches, rather than the human story of, like, this. Again, we've established that it's magical. This is how you get on the platform 9¾. We don't need to dwell on it because we care about the human side of the story. We don't need constantly bells and whistles.
The shock and awe is kind of gone now. And I think that's good on you, Kevin. I like talking to Kevin anyway, and good point too, Amy. I think that's something that I noticed definitely this far into this book is, like, okay, I too have kind of looked past, like, yeah, there's toys that walk around and whatever. But now I'm more interested in that we're getting to, like, kind of the more of the story that's going to have some, like you said, human elements. So
yeah, I dig that. And Amanda and Kevin just confirmed they'll be joining us later for two chapters in, like, the late 20s. I forget exactly which chapters. But
awesome. Yeah. It's always fun when they're on.
Yep. And so, yeah, but none of the adults will tell them anything about what we know to be the Triwizard Tournament. And they settle down and they hear a little bit of conversation of Malfoy with Crabbe and Goyle and his goonies about Durmstrang.
Yes. And the thing we're not supposed to know about, Malfoy knows about. And they're also talking about the, Durmstrang. I'm sorry, I'm trying to find my place here because I marked something.
Yeah, Father. Oh. Or go ahead.
Go ahead, sorry. No.
Father actually considered sending me to Durmstrang rather than Hogwarts, you know? He knows the headmaster, you see. Well, you know his opinion of Dumbledore. The man's such a mudblood lover, and Durmstrang doesn't admit that sort of riffraff. But Mother didn't like the idea of me going to school so far away. Father says Durmstrang takes a far more sensible line than Hogwarts about the Dark Arts. Durmstrang students actually learn them, not just the defense rubbish we do.
Oh boy, Malfoy. Couldn't get away from him. I did like how they have him talking about his parents. It definitely sounds very formal. More of a, like, my mom and dad or something, a little, you know, mother and father. That's always kind of a very... Yeah. Says a certain thing.
Yeah. And I think it's also, maybe he says mom and dad in private, but when speaking of them to other people, and especially not in their presence, they're always mother and father.
That's I just thought that was a little interesting.
Yeah. And just the idea, definitely, but Mother didn't like the idea of me going to school so far away. So from what we've seen of Lucius Malfoy already, it definitely is not a stretch to assume that Narcissa Malfoy is, like, the softer parent.
Yeah, and I think even Ron later on says it's a shame his mother likes him or something like that. So that is a good point. Lucius, yeah. I think Lucius, probably much like Malfoy, is all about Lucius, and that's pretty much it.
So they go in this little spiel about Durmstrang and just the idea that no one knows exactly where Durmstrang is because it's been made unplottable. There's tons of enchantments on it, but it's definitely the suggestion that it is super up north, and kind of the insinuation that Beauxbatons is all of Western Europe. Gets all the witches and wizards from continental Western Europe, and then Durmstrang tends to take all the Slavic and Eastern European students. So there is this, I see it as being a very stark division between East and West.
Gotcha. Okay.
I would be curious about the hit. I don't know if Harry Ryder ever elaborates on this, but it would be nice to see exactly how Bulbatone and Durmstrang, you know, were formed, and if that has any relation to how the Roman Empire split apart with the western part Rome and the eastern part in Constantinople.
Yeah, it would be interesting to get more in depth on both of those schools and know more. And I don't know if I'm going to know more other than, you know, kind of what you've shared. I also appreciated the explanation via Hermione on, you know, hidden Hogwarts and the other schools, because it's something that I think I've, you know, we've talked about, and I think that I just kind of had a mental block about, and I appreciated that whole exchange because it helped me. It was interesting. It's like, well, of course those schools would be hidden because essentially Hogwarts is hidden. And anyway.
Yeah. Although definitely there's got to be more than just like an illusion of the castle looking ruined and saying don't enter unsafe, because, you know, there are paranormal fanatics like us and others who would still be trying to get in. So they've got to have more muggle repellent charms than simply that.
Right. Right. I did appreciate that, because that, you know, now it'll make me walk by any house and I'll be like, maybe that's the like Midwest school for the wizards. I don't know.
Brain's getting heavier and heavier. Run into a few others like Seamus and Dean and Neville. Neville didn't get to go because his grandma didn't want to. Boo. Like, just you should have let him just go with like his great uncle, whoever, what's his name.
Right.
The poor kid have some fun.
Yeah, he doesn't need to be. I mean, I know he mentions later on that she's very much about their name, but I know it's kind of unrelated here. But yeah, let poor Neville hang out with his friends a little bit.
Yep. And then Malfoy decides to join.
Blech, always.
And again, we saw him right at the top. Who was saying what? We saw him right up close as well, said Ron. We were in the top box for the first and last time in your life, Weasley. Again, for as poor as Arthur is, he's such a nice guy and helps so many people out that he can get certain perks to the point of he was in the top box. He and his family were in the top box with the equivalent of the prime minister.
Right. Yeah. So there's like, I guess it's kind of various forms of, you know, currency. Malfoy is all about, you know, money, and they have this nice fancy whatever, and they're wealthy. And I also know there's the additional prejudice of being purebloods, but the Weasley families are purebloods as well. So he can't really use that, but he always gets back to, you know, their money. And I don't quite understand why he's taking such pleasure in teasing the Triwizard Tournament. It's a hard thing for me to say, but he definitely feels pretty cool about hanging this over their head while he's, you know.
Yes. Well, them. I think Malfoy is so desperate again to knock the Weasleys down a peg again, because it's showing that Arthur has a certain level of social capital that he can get certain things in the same way that Lucius can get certain things. They just go about it in different ways with different resources. And I think there's a sense of, like, with Arthur's social capital, he doesn't like promote the pure bloodness or anything, and he's not like one of the old like aristocratic pure blood families, but the fact remains is that in this society pure bloods are so few and far between, like in this society. Yeah. That again, if they, you know, it's said in the second book by Ron, if we didn't like intermarry with muggles, we would have died out. So I think there's a sense that even Arthur doesn't have money, he's still a pureblood, which is pretty rare in this society.
Yeah, and seems to be reasonably well liked, I think, and thus allowing him access and some things like that, where the Malfoys kind of just use fear.
Yeah, because would Arthur have the same social capital if he was a half-blood or a muggle-born? Maybe not.
Yeah, hard to say.
So, yeah, Malfoy is all about teasing Ron for his 1890 version of dress robes because, again, he can't get a new angle or a new, very one-dimensional. It's just, like, not, again, there are kids like this, and I don't know. It's just something that's especially, you know, kids are shitty in a lot of ways in terms of bullying and things like that. But I think it's especially shitty when teenagers pull in socioeconomic stuff when at the end of the day, they do not contribute to that socioeconomic status in any way, shape, or form. They're purely riding the coattails on whatever their situation is with the parents.
Yeah. And it's, you know, they don't know at this point. I mean, I don't, that concept isn't like fully formed, I don't think, but it is, it's kind of, again, I think it's definitely the parents that perpetuate this idea. And I think if I remember right, Lucius made some little condescending comment as well when they were in the box. So it's like, you know, monkey see, monkey do, I guess a little bit. And, it is a little unfair and kind of annoying. I mean, like, not to be a jerk, but there are so many more things that he could make fun of Ron for. Like his hair, his like freckles, his kind
or
of
or his deathly fear of spiders.
Or his fear of spiders. Yeah, like so many things, but we're just going to stick to like, you're poor. I guess maybe Malfoy is secretly self-conscious about, maybe he's also scared of spiders. I don't know. Maybe he's self-conscious about some of those things, which is why he doesn't say anything.
I like to think that he's secretly subconscious about, you know, how many people are really my friends and how many people want my money.
Yeah, that is. And I know that that is something that people that with money often are self-conscious about, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But again, just so desperate to pull Ron and the rest of the Weasleys down because he cannot deal with the fact that, you know, that Arthur Weasley or the Weasleys could have any social capital just by Arthur being a nice guy and getting perks. And then also the fact they have the social capital of their buddy with Harry Potter.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Because why a lot of people do this sort of Draco Harry pairing in fan fiction is, you know, Malfoy is still so bitter that he could not get more social capital by being buddy with Harry Potter.
Right. Yeah, you're exactly right. And I think that was at the kind of the beginning. I mean, this is, I guess, a fan fiction if Harry would have been sorted into Slytherin. I almost call it Slitherclaw, but that's wrong. Yeah. Just, you know, how different Malfoy. I don't know. It would just be interesting how that relationship would have been. I don't know.
Yeah. And then, you know, Malfoy eventually leaves and Ron is like, father's always associated with the top people of the ministry. Dad could have gotten a promotion anytime. He just likes it where he is. Of course he does, says Hermione. Don't let Malfoy get to you. So that's just interesting, you know. Is Ron being truthful? Or is he saving face? Like, it's just that question of, again, with the nature, you know, we don't see Arthur all that much. And certainly not in his at the ministry. So is that true in the sense of dad could get a promotion or maybe he could get a promotion, but he would have to tone down all of his muggle lovingness or how much of it is a legitimate, you know, Arthur could get a promotion without changing any substantial elements of himself? Or is it because of his muggle proclivities? That holds him back in his career where there is this, you know, implicit bias.
I think that's a good question. And I think that's also a good point that especially, I don't know, given my age or the age of the generation that's probably reading this or grew up with this, like achieve, achieve, achieve. That's kind of like what we're taught to do is just achieve, 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 achieve. And I also think that adds a different another complexity to Malfoy's like misunderstanding of the Weasleys is maybe, you know, Arthur Weasley is content where he's at. I don't know if anybody's content, you know, being poor, but, you know, maybe that he's just kind of like, you know, this is fine. Eventually the kids will be out of the house and we'll be comfortable. And Draco doesn't understand that at all. Yeah.
Or the sense of maybe Arthur Weasley is a Ned Stark who isn't willing to completely transform himself to succeed in more Machiavellian style.
I guess I understand where both those parties are coming from in some capacity, so.
Yep. And so then they finally reach the station in Hogsmeade. It's still pouring down rain, and they get a glimpse of Hagrid.
Yes, good old Hagrid, close to Hogwarts.
Yeah. Ooh, I wouldn't fancy crossing the lake in this weather, said Hermione fervently. So yeah, it's just continuing to pour down rain, and they get in the carriages, and they set off towards Hogwarts Castle.
170 pages in, and we're only now getting to Hogwarts. That's crazy town, but wow. That's cool.
And then we move on to chapter 12, the Tri-Wizard Tournament. And through the gates, flanked with statues of winged boars, and up the sweeping drive, carriages trundled. Trundled. That must be a very British verb.
Yeah.
Swaying dangerously in what was fast becoming a gale. So yeah. Storm raging, they're all soaking wet, and Peeves decides to be a dick and throw water balloons, which, again, they're already soaking wet. Not all that creative.
It's like just adding salt to the wound. Like, you thought you were going to get dry, but I guess not so much. Which then we have, you know, McGonagall telling him to chill out. And
I just have
almost slipping.
I have this amazing image, again, because it says Professor McGonagall skidded across the floor and had to cling to Hermione to stay upright. I tickled by the fact of McGonagall in that sort of physical comedy.
Yeah, that's it. And that's, you know, it's interesting, like Hermione and Professor McGonagall, that's kind of the second, there's another time in this chapter where they're mentioned kind of in conjunction with each other. So I feel like there's a little bit of allusion to Hermione's future. I don't know, everybody. So please don't be too mean to me. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think Emma Watson when she's an old woman, she would love there be a reboot of Harry Potter where she played McGonagall.
I would love to watch that too. She's a doll, so I would love to watch that.
So McGonagall shoos Peeves away, and they start meandering into the Great Hall for the feast.
Yeah. We missed the feast a couple times.
So yeah, this is the first time we are getting a Sorting Hat song since Harry's own sorting, because book two was Crashing Car into the Whomping Willow.
Yes.
And Prisoner of Azkaban was, passing out because of Dementor and going seeing Madame Pomfrey and Hermione surreptitiously getting the Time Turner off stage.
Yes, off stage, yes. Yeah.
So yeah, this is the first time that we're sitting down in the Great Hall, like he's supposed to, waiting for the sorting.
Props to this song, because it is much, I don't know how it's depicted in the movies. I looked back at the first one, and this is far more interesting than the first song, which was just kind of ridiculous.
Are you talking about the Sorting Hat song or the anthem?
The Sorting Hat song. Didn't he sing a little song in the first book?
He did.
The Sorting Hat? Okay.
I may not be pretty, but don't judge by what you see. I'll eat myself if you can find a smarter hat than me. It was very Dr. Seuss, wasn't it? Just reciting it again.
I just re-looked at it, and I just remember, like, I enjoyed this. Like, I enjoyed reading this, and I felt like it had some interesting storytelling. The first one, I just remember being like, this is the moment where I feel like I'm too old I'm not too old for these books, but this little section made me feel like an old lady. So
yeah. And there's Colin, the president of the Harry Potter fan club, basically is telling Harry, oh, my brother is coming to school this year.
Poor Colin.
And I hope he's
he's just an admirer, I guess.
Yeah. And so he's like, I hope he's in Gryffindor. And Harry's like, aren't siblings usually in the same house? Like, because all the Weasleys are in Gryffindor. And it seems like a good chunk of the Malfoys and Slytherin, you know, families in Slytherin tend to all be there. And Hermione's like, not necessarily. Pavarti Patil in Gryffindor, she has an identical twin and she's in Ravenclaw.
Right. I guess I never really gave much thought to that and probably just assumed that all the family would be in the same house. But like, my brother's probably a Gryffindor, so he wouldn't be a Hufflepuff. Well, he's kind of a Hufflepuff.
I think it's shining, and in the also with the hat's song, it's shining a little more nuance into the housing system and these four character archetypes and how much of it is being dictated by nature versus nurture. How much of it is being dictated by their upbringing? If it's more nurture, then it makes sense that siblings born in the same household with parents with the same values end up in the same house. Whereas nature, they just totally go off in a different direction from their sibling or from their parent.
Yeah, that makes good sense. That makes good sense. It was just something I was surprised, like after reading this, I was like, oh, I never really thought about that. And now I'm going to notice it.
Mm-hmm. And so who is it? Dennis finally, where is it? So we've got the Sorting Hat's new song. So what did you like about this compared to his first song?
You know, I'm leaning down to grab the book. The first song was really short and, you know, it was kind of silly and, you know, nothing wrong with that. There's a time and a place. But this one just had more detail. It kind of talked about the different houses and, you know, is it just kind of a surface level overview of them? Sure. But I don't, it went more in depth on the houses, I think, than the last time. And I'm looking back at the first one. I don't know. I thought I liked that. I didn't like this. And now that I'm reflecting back on it, I don't dislike it as much as I thought. So maybe there was something else that bothered me. I don't know.
So, yep, we get Sorting Hat's song and they start sorting all the little first years. And Dennis Creevy gets sorted into Gryffindor.
Yes. And he has this moment where apparently he fell into the river and the squid helped him out. So again, I need to not be scared of the squid.
Yes. It's like, I fell in and then something in the water grabbed me and pushed me back into the boat. Cool, said Colin. It was probably the giant squid, Dennis. Wow, said Dennis, as though nobody in their wildest dreams could have hoped for more than being thrown into a storm-tossed fathoms-deep lake and pushed out of it again by a giant sea monster.
I'm assuming these two are muggle-born, right?
Yeah, yes. Colin was petrified, was attacked. So they are both muggle-born.
Okay. I forgot about that, yeah. The being so enamored with everything, like, right away definitely kind of signals to me, like, muggle-born.
And so, but what is, I forget what item, which exact name it is, but the writer Harry got some fan mail from a girl who was terminally ill with cancer. And so Harry decided to add that girl's name into the sorting ceremony.
Okay.
So I forget, it's Mary, not Mary, it starts something with an M. I'm looking. What we got here?
I'm looking as well.
Number start. No, I can't find exactly. I don't remember which one, but I know it's in Goblet of Fire. Anyway.
Okay.
Wait, interesting. I digress. So Dumbledore's like, I have only two words for you, Tuckin. And all the food appears, and Ron's being a pig, talking through a mouthful of mashed potatoes.
We've all been there, I guess. I don't know.
All been there at Thanksgiving, I know. But
yeah. I wanted to, okay, so I'm a bit of a romance reader, too. So I like the little hints that we are getting about Harry's interest in girls. So I highlighted the, for a fleeting second when he sees Cho Chang, and for a fleeting second, Harry had a strange desire to join the Ravenclaw table too. I just kind of like these little hints of his like romantic, leanings towards Cho Chang.
So. Yeah. Which is interesting that again, his whole identity is wrapped around, you know, being a Gryffindor, and part of that is natural of just the tribal groupthink of kids and cliques and things like that. And also especially for him, because it's not so much defining himself as, yeah, as Gryffindor is great. It's again, as we discussed, you know, the nationalism aspect of defining yourself to an other. And so because Voldemort represents all of the Slytherin qualities, he by default wants to be the absolute opposite and really doubles down on all his Gryffindor identity and ideals. So it's interesting that in terms of his romantic leanings, as you said, he's branching out and has found someone from a different house.
Yeah. Yeah. Love is love, right? He just is attracted to who he's attracted to. So.
Yeah. And so through a conversation with nearly headless Nick, Hermione comes to the realization that there are house elves at Hogwarts.
I marked this part. There are house elves here, she said, staring horror-struck at nearly headless Nick, here at Hogwarts. So, if I may, this reminded me of I may have mentioned this before, I've always been very proud of my roots, which are very deep in the South. And for some reason, I didn't really put together what that fully meant. And then, you know, doing some genealogy research, I understood what that meant. And it made me a little less proud, a lot less proud of that heritage. So it's one of those things that I was mad at myself for, because I thought, well, of course, there was something like this. You know, it's kind of like, I think, the same feeling that Hermione would be having, like, well, where the hell do you think all this food came from? You know, and maybe that's can be attributed to her being muggle-born, that maybe it's just kind of appears. But I also know she's a little smarter than that. So,
yeah, like, who does the laundry? Who makes the beds? Who cleans the, who sweeps the floors? Who dusts the bookshelves? Or, like, right. You know, there's all of this stuff. And again, as a muggle-born, you could make the assumption of, okay, this just magically does itself.
Right.
Although there are very specific, you know, it's not really, you don't really get into it until book 7, but there are very specific stipulations about food and magic. So you can't just, like, pop food out of thin air. You do need to, like, make it in some capacity and work with supplies. So at least especially when it comes to the kitchens, like, someone was doing it. Like, I guess she just thought it was staff or whatever.
I just kind of got the, which, since we're talking about that, I kind of got the impression that, like, Harry wrote the 3 books and then people are like, okay, but what about this? And what about this? And he's like, all right, fine. I'll try to expose more throughout this book and let you guys, you know, let my readers understand a little bit more, you know, kind of lift the veil. I know this is kind of happening in real time, but it's kind of like slowly unfolding some of the things that weren't necessarily understood in the first couple books.
Yep. And Hermione's like, but they get paid. They get holidays, don't they? And sick leave and pensions and everything.
Did she not listen? Come on, Hermione. They don't want it.
Yep. And she refuses to eat another bite.
Hermione and her pride, right?
Yeah. And her convictions.
Yes.
And then we get, and Hermione, Ron is like, treacle tart, Hermione, said Ron, deliberately wafting its smell toward her. Spotted Dick, look, chocolate gâteau.
Yeah, he's trying to tempt her, but I feel like we know how, now me, I would be like, oh my gosh, okay, I'll have another bite. I'll deal with the other stuff later, probably, but Hermione is.
I didn't think of it all that much, reading, but just now, and especially Ron with Molly Weasley, and so, you know, they don't have a lot of things, but one of the good things they have is, like, just really good food constantly. Yeah. And that's probably a symbol of love in the Weasley household. And so Ron is just like, please eat. This is how I show I care about you.
I know some women like that in my life. So it's, I think one time I heard an expression called biscuit pusher, which that's kind of unrelated. It's when you want to eat something bad, like, maybe Ron is a bit of a biscuit pusher. He's like, he's wants not to feel as guilty about eating what he's eating. So he's like, come on, please eat so I don't feel as bad. I don't know.
Well, that could be possible. It could be possible he is maybe actually thinking about the deeper implications of house elf stuff and he's trying to squash it. But, like, please don't. I don't want to critically think about this. Just eat the food and shut up.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's pretty easy for a lot of folks to do that. So, yeah.
Yep. And then Dumbledore comes back on stage.
Thank God.
And reiterates Mr. Filch what he has banned, In terms of screaming yo-yos, fanged frisbees, and ever-bashing boomerangs, full list comprises some of 437 items. I believe they can be viewed in Mr. Filch's office if anyone would like to check it.
Yeah, we know who he's talking about here. So,
and Dumbledore drops the bomb. No Quidditch this year.
Yeah, I feel like I love Dumbledore's dramatics here because he knows. I mean, he's a good host. Or he's a good comedian, good actor. He's just
good performer.
Yes.
All teachers have to be performers to a certain extent. They're on their feet all day in front of a class. That's true. A lot of them who don't want to give them their attention usually because they're being forced to by society and the system and the man.
Yeah. That's very true.
Yeah, which is why I'm all for a complete rehaul of education and letting kids have more freedom in what they study. Or at least freedom within certain parameters.
Probably end up with happier people that way, right?
So Dumbledore explains that Quidditch is canceled because another event will be taking place in October and continuing throughout the school year, taking up much of the teacher's time and energy. And so he finally says the words that it is the Triwizard Tournament. But before he even gets to Triwizard Tournament, it's the dramatic entrance of Mad-Eye Moody.
Yeah. So this is like he's up there right about to announce it. And then, Mad-Eye Moody shows up. And sometimes I read this and I'm like, I can't wait to see what this looks like in the film. Because in my head, it looks like a scene in another movie. It's probably not like that at all. But
my Mad-Eye Moody, I don't envision the actor or what they did in the movie. I envision Moody being like dark chestnut hair, and I almost imagine him having a sort of like more like olive tone to like contrast with this super big electric blue eye that he has. And I think that's been influenced because I've met a lot of Arabs, specifically those of that from Syria and Lebanon, where like that sort of area of the Arab world, they'll have the typical darker, skin of Arabs, but they'll also have these bright electric blue eyes.
Oh, wow.
So, I don't know why. I always just envisioned Mad-Eye Moody as sort of darker to contrast that big blue eye that he has.
That's an interesting.
I feel like the significance of that eye is lost if he's just Aryan with blonde hair.
Yeah. It's not as impactful. Your interpretation of it would definitely make it stand out.
Not only does he have this crazy eye, he has a wooden leg. I guess that's another reason why I think of him as darker, because I think of his like skin like being sort of like of the same tone of like the tree bark that his leg is carved out of.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm just trying, like, this is the problem with, when movies come out and you see things like that, like, that's the depiction in my head is him. So, of course, as I'm reading this, that's who I'm seeing. But, he has a wooden leg. Basically, this poor guy is torn up from probably his job, right? From his encounters with dark wizards.
Yeah, and probably, a good chunk of them in league with Voldemort. And yeah, and it's you don't get the reputation of, occupying 50% of Azkaban without a few scratches.
Right. And I have so many questions after we get to the Triwizard Tournament. I only have like 3 questions, but I'm just very confused about some of the decision making at Hogwarts, but we'll get there.
Mm-hmm. Moody, Harry muttered to Ron. Mad-Eye Moody, the one your dad went to help this morning? Must be. What happened to him? What happened to his face? Don't know, Ron whispered back, watching Moody with fascination. Moody seemed totally indifferent to his less than warm welcome. Ignoring the jug of pumpkin juice in front of him, he reached out again in his traveling coat, pulled out a hip flask, and took a long draft from it.
He does not give a damn. He's drinking in front of the children. he's like, I've seen some stuff and I'll talk to you about it.
Yeah, he's like, I'm so over this.
Yes, I get it, man.
Although, I didn't think about it all that much. Just the scarring of Moody makes me think of, again, people who not are born with a disfigurement, but who, again, get, get scratches or scars, because, like, it's described as Remus Lupin has a few scars on him, mm-hmm. you know, and on his face, you know, from, you know, his life as a werewolf. But yeah, this level of disfigurement, I don't know, I just had a horrible vision of, you know, people like who throw acid on women.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Or again, with, you know who I'm thinking of? Because I'm doing Game of Thrones, the Hound, Sandor Clegane.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah,
because that's
not a born disfigurement. That's something his brother gave to him.
Yeah. It made me think of this book that I just finished, and I'm not going to mention because it was not good. So, but that it was the same thing. The lead character had a bunch of scarring. So in a moment, when I was reading this, I was like, am I reading? No. Oh, no, no, no. Yeah. So I'll tell you off mic, but I'm not going to mention it here.
Okay. And it's just interesting, the notion of, you know, we're getting this sense that, you know, Harry lost bones in his arms and Madame Pomfrey could regrow them. You know, they can take care of substantial injuries in a way that Muggles can't. So what does it say with Mad-Eye Moody that his eye was so beyond magical repair that he replaced it with a magical eye that they could not save
right.
his natural eye by any magical means?
Yeah, so this, I mean, so he, again, he has seen some stuff. Like, he is war-torn, and I'm sure he has some stories to tell.
Mm-hmm. And so after that, as Kevin would say, dropping the turd in the punch bowl in the yeah. appearance of Mad-Eye Moody, Dumbledore finally gets around to saying that they're going to host the Tri-Wizard Tournament.
And Fred Weasley was, I could hear his voice in my head. And of course everybody laughed, and Dumbledore says, I'm not joking. Now, the thing that, Dumbledore tells kind of like tries to tell a silly joke, but McGonagall like kind of is like, like, let's keep going. He then continues to describe the Triwizard Tournament, who is going to be involved, but he doesn't really go into depth into what those, like, the competition really is going to be yet.
Yeah, and I can't. And there's the, from what he describes, the nature of the competition will change substantially from its historical counterpart, because apparently the challenges and the stuff they did in the first renditions, the death toll became so great that they discontinued it. So whatever they're planning, it's going to look substantially different than what it did look like in the past.
It's like Wizard Hunger Games, it sounded like. They're killing a bunch of kids off.
Honestly, I want to do a scholarly Slytherclaw comparing Triwizard Tournament with, like, Hunger Games and, like, the marine fighting pits in Game of Thrones.
Oh, man.
Like, again, that notion of trying to use sport and competition to sate that desire for violence when you don't have war.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, That would be very interesting. That just made me think of, I mean, the death toll with the kids, which obviously Hermione is like, death toll? Like, what is going on with this And obviously, again, this must be something based on the Fred's reaction that the, you know, wizard kids know about. But
yes. Yeah. So, like, it does exist in the wizard psyche.
Right. But the, you know, kind of non-wizard kids. The Muggleborns are a little in the dark about it, and as am I. I don't know either.
Mm-hmm. And this is specifically for the three European schools of
yes.
Beauxbatons, Durmstrang, and Hogwarts. And Dumbledore goes on to say that, you know, because we're redoing the rules, everything to be safe, you have to be of age, legally of age, aka you have to be at least 17.
Yeah. And if I were anybody else, you would think that that would automatically eliminate Harry. But I know this book story. I know these stories better. Harry's going to weasel his way in there somehow. So.
Yep. So, and Fred and George are significantly put out by this scenario. And then Dumbledore tries to say, I therefore beg you not to waste your time submitting yourself if you are under 17.
Yeah, because Fred and George immediately kind of start trying to hatch this plan where they're going to, because there's a fairly large prize if they win. I forgot how many galleons it was. Oh, and a thousand galleons. Okay, so there's like, it would be something that obviously they would want to win the money and whatever. But so they're trying to scheme a plan to get themselves entered, which I'm like, you got Dumbledore here kind of making sure that no wizard younger than X, you know, 17 gets in. They think they're going to slip one past him. I don't know.
Well, the way they're thinking about this is it's not so much Dumbledore's decision that there is this judge. So it's like Dumbledore is not even a person to consider. They just have to, you know, convince this one specific person. So,
yeah, I don't know. I just think it's funny that they think that they can like circumvent these rules.
Oh, the folly of youth.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right.
And one thing that's interesting is, again, you know, it's kind of a little unfair of the sense that it makes sense that you don't have this, you know, pretty substantial competition, you know, and not have an age limit on it. But then you ruin the Quidditch and having no Quidditch for all the rest of the students. Like what I was thinking, I thought would be really cool. They should have had a Triwizard tournament, like for differing levels, like with certain,
yeah,
with upping the ante for each, you know, level, so that more kids could participate.
That would be interesting. If
you completely take away Quidditch, because again, not that I want to read about Quidditch, but just it's not fair to them that they, that basically the only thing they get out of this is to be like spectators of this Triwizard tournament and not like actually be part of it all that much.
Yeah, it does kind of eliminate a whole big thing for a lot of students because it is only three wizards that get to compete. Well, one from each school.
Yeah, so it's literally only the whole everyone at Hogwarts is denied Quidditch for one student in the whole student body to be the Triwizard champion.
Which is probably going to be Harry Potter. Anyway, somehow. We'll find out. But anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so then they totter off to bed.
Yes. And, you know, Hermione is still upset about the house elves. And,
mm-hmm. And, you know. Yeah. Ron and Harry are chatting amongst themselves and it's like, do you want to enter if Fred and George find a way? And again, Harry's desire to get glory for himself that is totally separate from his current celebrity that he did nothing for.
Right. Yeah. He kind of drifts off to sleep thinking about winning.
Yeah, winning Triwizard Tournament and Cho admiring him.
Come on, Harry. So he was exceptionally... This sentence was funny, and I'm sorry to everybody, but Harry grinned into his pillow, exceptionally glad that Ron couldn't see what he could. What? Just thought that was a weird... I mean, I know what I thought about that sentence. I was just like...
That is the first time I read it as very dirty since you pointed it out.
Well, like I said, I read romance, so I'm reading this and I'm going, what? What are y'all doing here? But anyway.
Oh, dear. And thus concludes chapter 12.
Kind of an interesting couple of chapters because I felt like not a lot happened, but some things did happen. It hasn't been like a couple chapters ago where it was like everything happened. Every sentence there was something going on. This one was kind of like, we're just kind of easing back into the school year, I guess. Yeah.
There's so much buildup in Goblet of Fire compared to the first three, the trilogy of the three, because it's just like this happened and this happened and this happened. And now it's much more, again, subtle and built in building things up and dropping a lot of, you know, miscellaneous details that are both just general world building and then some that are actually important to the plot, which of course you missed and I'm not going to tell you.
Okay, good. Good. I don't want to know. I feel like I know too much already. So.
So shall we move to Gothic Geek Out?
Yes, we should.
Mm-hmm. So my gothic geek out is just the fact it's the huge rain and lightning storm in front of this castle. Because it's like...
Oh, that's a good one.
Because just constant, like, the rain and the lightning and everything. It's so horrible that you get thrown into the lake and sea monsters are dragging you back out. And
It does have a very, like, gothic-y intro for those first years. Yeah, very, very dramatic entrance, which is kind of cool, but also kind of scary. I don't know if I'd, you know, I think a couple of them say I wouldn't want to be on the boat during this storm.
Because I thought of when I was reading this is I recently went hiking and it started raining. Like I was 15 minutes, you know, after 2 hours, I was 15 minutes from the end of the trail where, you know, my car was parked. And so it started raining and I'm like, okay, I don't care that it's like, you know, raining, like I can handle getting wet, but the lightning was so close and I was in a forest and I'm just like, please, I don't want the lightning to hit a tree and catch the tree on fire or have the tree fall on me and squish me like a bug.
Yeah. That is, that's how I think about things too. Lightning storms in the forest are never.
And I just have an extra fear of that after that tree fell on my car.
That didn't happen recently, did it?
No, that happened in 2017, but I'm still scarred from it. Again,
I would be too.
The insurance, you know, paid for it and everything, but still I'm just like, well, I'm glad, because it was like a few days before Thanksgiving, and I'm like, well, I'm glad I wasn't planning to drive anywhere.
Right, yeah. Oh my goodness.
That's about the... Just the HOA was so incompetent. It took days for them to hire some people to get the tree off my goddamn car.
That's annoying. What an inconvenience. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. But what was your gothic geek out?
Well, I feel like y'all should know me well enough that if there is mention of a ghost, then I'm going to have to hone in on that. So the meeting of the ghost council regarding Peeves, I think it was his attendance somewhere. Ghosts being mentioned in a group was very exciting to me. The other thing was Mad-Eyed Moody. It seemed a bit like a gothic kind of almost Quasimodo kind of figure. He's got a story. He's drinking, you know, he's obviously seen some things. I feel like he could, if I'm going to stick with the romance line that I've obviously just kind of started down that path, you know, kind of put him in a little bit more, I don't know, rugged, whatever. Like I said, I can't get the film version out of my head, but I could see you could make him like a Van Helsing looking kind of guy too. That would be kind of a fun way to look at him. So
there is the sort of, you can go two ways. You can either have like the head of the owner of the castle or manor be very polished and super handsome and, you know, have all those aristocratic qualities. Or you could have the opposite where the head of the house, again, has a disformity of some kind or is really intimidating in some other physical way.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that... I think we did a good job of finding gothicness in these couple chapters. I was a little worried, and then I kind of took a step back and thought.
Oh. Yeah. Well, again, we finally got at Hogwarts, so we finally got gothic things again.
We're in, like, goth central a little bit, so that's good.
And then we move on to Tarot of the Day. And at random, the card I pulled yesterday for these chapters was the Knight of Swords.
Okay.
I don't think we've pulled out pages, but I don't think we've ever pulled out a knight before.
I don't think so either.
So swords always deal with like the intellectual side, the element of air, depending on how you look at it. As with all knights of the tarot deck, the Knight of Swords is a man or woman on a mission. Once he has his mind set on something, nothing is stopping him, and as a sword card, the knight actively uses the power of his intelligence to achieve his goals. When the Knight of Swords appears in a tarot reading, is it a sign that you are highly driven, ambitious, and action-oriented? You are so highly motivated to succeed that you will stop at nothing to pursue your dreams. The challenges, difficulties, and obstacles on the path ahead don't faze you because you know where you want to go. Move forward with sheer strength and determination to make things happen.
I guess I could interpret that as the Weasley's ambition to get into the Triwizard Tournament, no matter how silly they would be. But I feel like that's a very, I'm still thinking about it.
Yeah. I think of Mad-Eye Moody just in his general demeanor that we get in the Great Hall, where he doesn't give a crap and is just very, you know, we, from the reputation we know of him, that he was clearly very highly driven and was very successful, and that's why he put away so many people in Azkaban. But also in terms of, it also says here, what else? The Knight of Swords suggests you are quick to take action and tend not to plan ahead, again, which Mad-Eye Moody, his whole shenanigans before he got to the castle with Arthur, because he just immediately enchanted the Despins to go crazy and attack whatever, and we don't even know if there was a legitimate threat or not.
Right. Yeah, that's a... I keep thinking about him in different ways I would like to see him depicted, and not necessarily the way the movie went, so...
Yeah. The Knight of Swords reminds you to be assertive in getting what you want. He doesn't hang back and wait for something to happen. He is always making the first move and actively pursuing his goals. So...
Yep. There's the Weasleys trying to get into the Triwizard Tournament. They're actively pursuing their goal of doing that.
Actively pursuing their goal. And again, to a certain extent, Hermione, in terms of, you know, completely switching gears when she realizes that house elves, that Hogwarts, the running of Hogwarts is partially dependent on slave labor.
Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, that's all I can think of. But I think, yeah, pretty good for... this card. Just again, knights are always about pushing energy forward.
Okay.
Yep. And then we pulled for the rune. I pulled out a rune that I know we've done before, which is Perthrow. And that is basically the rune of mystery.
Okay.
So yeah, so basically, you know, to reiterate, Perthrow is one of the most enigmatic of runes. Its meaning unknown and can only be inferred from the Old English rune poem, which refers to it as ever play and laughter, where warriors sit in the beer hall together. The most common meaning assigned are the lot cup or gaming piece, both referring to games of chance, which were taken very seriously by the Germanic peoples as they were believed to reveal the extent of a person's luck. Okay, literal meaning, unknown, educated guess, having included gaming piece, lot cup, beer, song, sex, word, and apple tree. Rich meaning, word, mystery, flow, song, change, lung, chromatic, depth, renewal. So yeah, basically the mystery element, which what I get out of this section is, again, finally the mystery being revealed of the Triwizard Tournament, obviously. I feel like one mystery is answered with that, and then we're open to this whole new mystery, because we get the piece of information that Mad-Eye Moody is going to be a defense against the Dark Arts teacher. But again, just his whole demeanor, his whole physical presence raises a lot of questions, because what the hell has he gone through to be the way he is, both in his physicality and his personality?
Yeah, we never in the Harry Potter series so far, like, first of all, he's a defense against the Dark Arts teacher, so we know that, like, something's up there immediately. And secondly, like you said, with his big entrance and just kind of the background that he has, there's more to that story there that I hope unfolds. The mystery of Mad-Eye Moody and his background. I would also like to say the mystery of why the hell they're having a Triwizard Tournament when Voldemort, they just saw the, like, dark mark, and all this chaos is swirling. And then they're basically having, like, Voldemort bait show up at Hogwarts. So.
What's Voldemort bait?
I think Moody is Voldemort bait, because, you know, obviously he's put all these people in Azkaban and who were supporters of Voldemort. So Voldemort probably doesn't think very highly of Mr. Moody, so.
Probably not.
So I would like to understand what they're thinking. Now, I know, like, events are, I was, like, trying to rationalize this when I was thinking about, like, events are probably scheduled, so it's hard to cancel them. But I'm also like, no, that's a mystery to me.
Yeah, well, I guess it depends on how seriously do you take the Dark Mark? We as readers and how Harry wrote this, particularly with us being opened in the Riddle House and what Voldemort is actually doing, we take the Dark Mark situation significantly more seriously because we know Voldemort is out there on the prowl in a way. Whereas if we didn't have that bit of information in terms of, yes, it was really terrible that it happened, but that doesn't mean that, you know, it's indicative of a growing, you know, trend.
True.
Like, I guess it's a situation of, yeah, again, how do you interpret, like, when someone spray paints a swastika on a Jewish person's house? Like, that doesn't mean the Third Reich is back, but again, if it's done with enough frequency, it shows that white supremacy and neo-Nazism is on the rise. So it's like, how much stock do you put in one specific instance, and what is its greater implications? Or does it have any, or is it isolated?
And I guess that's something that, again, I'm probably find out just kind of like all the hubbub at the Ministry of Magic and just do all of these things that have been going around. And then I just kind of thought, like, you know, why are we having this happen with kids? But, you know, there's probably more to the story that I don't know yet. As Amy says, nothing.
And then finally move on to our last exercise, fan fiction time.
I had a really hard time with this. I will just say that right now. But my fan fiction wondered if the death toll just wasn't a big deal. And it was like, what if we changed it to only young wizards? Like, what if it was just wizards below 17? And
what if it was just a Wizard Hunger Games?
Basically, like, what if we were just like, you know what? We're not worried about, we need to kind of thin the population a little bit. So let's do this.
Well, that
I don't
would,
know.
That would be in keeping with how the failed pedagogy of how much they endanger these students anyway, with the Forbidden Forest, with everything else.
It's like they selectively care about their well-being. Like, so
again,
I don't know.
Again, the questions of bodily harm, can, you know, because they withstand it, the teachers are more lax about it. And again, that kind of goes into the question I raised earlier. It's like, you know, if they wanted to be so gung-ho about, you know, we don't care about these students' safeties, they should have had, again, I think there should have been several levels of, you know, like in wrestling or whatever, like you have, you know, a certain tier of, you know, weight, like you can be in this category or this category. So there should have been like three or four tiers of like Triwizard Games, you know, depending on their level.
Yeah.
The only thing I can think of is, you know, it doesn't seem at this point that the government has a great deal of say in the education. They just let Dumbledore do his thing. But this is something like political with all the other schools internationally, so like a lot of eyes are upon them, so I have to make sure they do it right. So again, in the sense of not doing the right thing for the moral reason, doing the right thing because everyone is watching you.
I just know that, like, there's more to the story. Obviously there are like several hundred pages more to the story, but that was the best I could come up with. I really had a hard time. And like I said, I even had a hard time with that because, like, I'm almost 100% sure Harry Potter is going to be the Hogwarts person. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll sound like an ass here in another episode, but well, who knows? It's all good.
Yeah. So mine is also related to Triwizard Tournament, obviously, but what if more schools joined the tournament? So it wasn't the Triwizard Tournament.
So are we saying, like, rather than just the European school, it kind of went like
it was more the Olympics?
That would be a lot more fun because we could know about more schools.
Because technically, from what we know of Harry, who's written extra stuff, there's Beauxbatons, which is in France. There's Durmstrang, you know, in, you know, the super high north, Hogwarts. There is a American school called Ilvermorny.
Okay.
There's a school in the Amazon forest that supports all the South American wizards called Castelobroxo.
Okay.
There is a school in Japan called Mahotokoro.
Wow.
There's a school in Russia, Koldovstorets, and there is a school that serves all of Africa, which is Uagado.
I would rather see that tournament. I mean, not that I'm averse to seeing the Triwizard tournament, but I think that's more interesting, kind of similar to the Quidditch World Cup. Like, you know, mm-hmm. why not just keep it? It's interesting that you bring that up, because it's almost like there was a little bit of a, like, we're definitely expanding the wizarding world with this book. And
but it's still very Eurocentric.
Yes, it is still very Eurocentric. So it would be interesting to see it go further, or I don't know.
Yeah. But yeah, that would have been fun to have more people, you know, more people join Hogwarts and get, I don't know, I'm just fascinated by what, like, again, what the Japanese wizards look like in Mokotoroko. What was it? I should know. Mahotokoro. Yeah. I should be better with my Japanese, because my mother lived in Japan for several of her formative years.
I speak only English and I don't feel very cool about it. So that's what I will say. It would be interesting to see in kind of the different, you know, Hermione is very educated, but I think you, like you said, is very Eurocentric too. I don't know, and maybe I'm just not paying close enough attention, but she hasn't like read any books about like wizards of, you know, the Asian hemisphere or whatever, wizards of Africa.
Yeah, no, and it would be interesting culturally, because the wand is a very European, you know, instrument. So for a lot of wizards in Africa, Harry has written later on, they don't use wands. They just point their finger.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's just a totally different approach to magic and how magic has evolved for those two sets of wizards. So that would be interesting to see how that compares.
Yeah.
Alrighty then, and thus concludes this episode of Rambling Raven Puffs. Tune in next time for chapters 13 and 14, Mad-Eye Moody and the Unforgivable Curses. And it'll be extra special because the co-host of Podcaster's Landing, Natalia Ward, aka The Warden, will be joining us. So
very excited to meet her.
Yes, so stay tuned for that. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophie Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophie Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophieMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophie Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophieMareStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophie Mare Studios podcast.